word out to someone before he was killed? How much did this unknown person know?
What was the cause of the blast?
Cross asked. The fire department hasn't determined that yet, Seth replied. They're still fighting the flames. I'm hacking into surveillance cameras in the area to see what they can tell us.
Ludlow was dead, but the problem still wasn't contained. There was another rogue element in play. Stomach acid rose quickly in his throat, and he swallowed it down before he gagged. Stress aggravated his acid reflux, especially after a big meal. He didn't need this.
Where's the team that we sent out to Long Valley?
Agents Edwin Pessel and Stuart Bowers, Seth said. According to our security logs, they were the last people to enter and leave the building, minutes before the blast.
What do they have to say for themselves?
We haven't been able to reach them, but we've located their car. It's in the parking lot of a strip club downtown.
Something was very wrong with this picture. Cross swallowed back more acid.
Send some agents to the club and drag those two out. I want to talk to them. In the meantime, get our drone back over the strike zone. I want another look at it. I'll be right in.
He ended the call and went back inside to look for some Tums. He had a bad feeling he'd need handfuls of them today. Chapter 35. Prim, Nevada, July 21st, 5:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. There were three casino hotels off the I-15 on the Nevada side of the border with California. Whiskey Pete's, Buffalo Bill's, and the Prim Valley Resort. Depending on which direction you were traveling, Prim was either your first or last chance to gamble before crossing the state line. Margot drove. She hadn't said much since she'd picked up Ronnie and Ian. She'd come down from her adrenaline high about 20 miles outside of Las Vegas. Ronnie was asleep in the back seat, snoring loudly and wearing his aluminum foil helmet again. Margot stole a glance into the rearview mirror at Ronnie, then a sideways look at Ian in the passenger seat, before returning her attention to the road. Ian could tell that she had something on her mind.
"I have a question for you," she said. "When Ronnie left L.A. for Nevada, why did you go after him and try to talk him into coming back?"
"I thought he was mentally ill and needed help."
"Now what do you think?"
"He might be the sanest man I know."
"That's scary," she said.
"After everything we've been through, that's what scares you?"
"Yeah, because I'm beginning to think you're right."
She gave him a quick, worried glance.
"What does that say about us?"
"This is a crazy world, Margot. Maybe you need to be a little crazy to see it."
"I wish I couldn't see it. Then nobody would be shooting missiles at me."
She smiled and then shook her head, as if in disagreement with herself.
"That sounds crazy, too."
"Not given our situation," Ian said.
"You're right. I bet there's nothing either of us could say right now that wouldn't come off sounding insane."
"We're going to Los Angeles," Ian said.
"That's a perfect example," she said. "In any other context, that simple statement about the direction we're driving wouldn't sound like the ranting of a drooling, bug-eyed lunatic."
"I'm serious. That's where we're going."
Margot gave him a hard look that somehow captured her anger, her dismay, and her fatigue. It was quite a look.
"That's the worst possible place for us to go."
She didn't end her statement with, "You moron," but it was heavily implied in her patronizing tone of voice.
"It's my home," Ian said. "Not that I have an actual home there anymore. Blackthorn blew it up."
"Take the subtle hint. They'll be watching every place you've ever been, and everyone you've ever known. You can't go back."
"I ran away. Straker wouldn't do that, so I can't do that."
"That's stupid," she said. "Hey, I have an idea. Why not save time? Call Cross and tell him exactly where to send his killers."
She didn't mean it, of course. But once she said it, Ian knew that she was right. It was the perfect Straker move in this situation. All he had to do was figure out what happened next. The key was to think of it as a story, just like all the others that he'd plotted.
"You may be onto something," he said.
Margot sighed, relieved. I'm glad you're listening to reason. I'll take the first exit that comes along and head in another direction.
That's not what I meant. I'm talking about telling Cross where to find us.
I was being sarcastic, she said.
You were being creative. Sometimes the best stories come when your character makes the worst possible decision. I think this is one of those times.
She was silent for a few miles, and when she spoke again, she was calm and serious.
I'll take you to Los Angeles. But once we get there, you'll have an hour to convince me that your scheme works.
There was nothing patronizing about her tone of voice, but her mental and emotional fatigue were even more evident.
I've come with you this far, but I won't let you get me killed. I'll bail out before that can happen.
He knew she meant it. Frankly, he was surprised she'd stuck with him this long. I understand, he said. Fate is a bastard. Never let him choose how you'll die.
You can think like Clint Straker if you want, she said. But I'll punch you in the face if you talk like him again.
He knew she meant that, too.
Bethesda, Maryland, July 21st, 8:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Cross stormed into the control center. He'd left the house so quickly that he'd forgotten to take off his cardigan.
What have you got?
Victoria and Seth shared a look. Neither one of them wanted to deliver the bad news, but Victoria had more guts and enjoyed inflicting pain. This was going to hurt Cross.
Agents Pessel and Bowers weren't in the strip club. We don't know where they are. But we know Pessel logged into his computer before the blast, and we know what he was looking at.
Show me, Cross said.
Victoria swiped something off her screen and onto the media wall. Cross looked up and saw his own face staring back at him like a huge reflection. Pessel had no reason to be interested in Cross's biography, his location, or his photo. But Cross knew one man who did. A dead man.
Is the drone over the strike zone yet? Cross asked.
It's arriving now.
Victoria typed something on her keyboard, and Cross's picture and the media wall was replaced by the drone's camera view. The drone came around a hill of boulders and over the ruins of the compound, revealing the charred hulk of a helicopter that had obviously been blown apart. The room instantly fell silent, everyone stopping what they were doing to absorb what they were seeing on screen and the implications. Someone had shot down the helicopter with a rocket. Before Cross or anybody else could give it too much thought, the drone banked over the site, and as it came around again, something else came into view. Two words were written on the ground in large, jagged letters, formed out of pieces of blackened rubble. Fuck you.
Chapter 36. The drone kept circling the wreckage and the profane taunt. Cross felt the heat on his face, flushed with fury. Ludlow was still alive and giving him the finger. How had he survived?
Do you want us to send another team out there to clean that up? Victoria asked.
Absolutely not, Cross said. There's been too much activity out there already. The less we do to draw attention to that desolate spot, the better. If we leave it alone, it will probably be years before anybody stumbles across it. Besides, we don't know what booby traps Ludlow might have set. I'd rather some hiker or coyote set them off than lose any more of our people or equipment.
How can he still be alive? Seth said.
Because everything we know about Ludlow is a lie. He's somebody else entirely, someone with extensive training, a professional, Cross said. Then addressed all the operatives in the room. And you all missed it and gave me bad intel. You fucked up, and now three of our people are dead because of it. That's on you. Your priority, the only reason you exist on this earth, is to take down Ian Ludlow, whoever he really is. Tear apart his history and find his real one. I want to know where, when, and how he acquired his skills. I want to know his real agenda. He's played us. I want to know why and how so it never happens to us again. It's obvious that he writes those Straker books based on personal experience. Analyze every word that he's written. His real story is between the lines.
I'll start pulling up camera feeds from casino, business, and intersection cameras around our Las Vegas office, Seth said. I'll see if I can identify the car he's driving now, and find out where he's hiding or what direction he's heading in.
You can do that, Cross said. But it's not necessary. We don't need to find Ludlow.
We don't? Victoria said. Why not?
Cross pointed to the message on the media wall.
Because he's coming for us.
Seth's phone rang. He picked it up. Yes?
Seth listened for a moment, nodded, then turned to Cross.
Senator Holbrook is here to see you.
The chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee couldn't have picked a worse time for an unexpected visit. But Holbrook wouldn't have come for a face-to-face unless it was a high-priority issue.
Send him to my office, Cross said.
Seth relayed the instruction as Cross walked out, slamming the door behind him. He took his time going down the corridor so he could get a grip on his anger and force the color out of his face. He reached his office door at the same moment as the portly senator, who smiled broadly when he saw Cross.
Good morning, Will. I'm glad to see you in such a good mood, Senator.
They shook hands and Cross opened his office door.
At least now I know you didn't come down here because of a crisis.
That's not entirely true, Holbrook said, stepping into the room. It's a national crisis, and your decisive handling of it that brings me here.
Cross closed the door.
You can speak candidly. This office is totally secure.
I would hope so, Holbrook said. I just left the Oval Office. The President is very impressed with how you wrapped up this whole ugly business in less than 48 hours. It's phenomenal. You just bought him a second term.
We're glad to be of service.
Cross sat down in one of his guest chairs and Holbrook took the couch. The senator was so large that he needed the entire couch for himself.
The President is going to show his appreciation by signing a classified executive order tonight, giving Blackthorne control of the CIA's covert operations, Holbrook said. Healy and the White House counsel will inform you in person when that happens.
The day hadn't gone totally to shit after all.
I'm surprised Healy is willing to do that.
We're throwing him a big, fat carrot. The CIA and Belgian intelligence will share the credit for resolving this mess. Healy will resign in a few months as a national hero, and Belgian intelligence won't be seen as a joke anymore. It's good politics, Will. You'll understand.
Cross didn't care who got the bragging rights. He got the personal glory of taking over the CIA, and in doing so, pulling off perhaps the greatest covert action in the history of espionage. Not that anyone would know about it but him, at least during his lifetime. He could live with that.
I'm only interested in what's best for our country, Cross said.
I appreciate that, Will. The President will address the nation tomorrow morning, tell them that the skies are safe again, and then he'll start bombing Syria into the Stone Age. That means more Pentagon business for you, too.
Holbrook winked at Cross.
This is your lucky day.
Perhaps it was. But right now what came to his mind were the words, "Fuck you," written in rubble in the wilds of Nevada. Tarzana, California, July 21st, 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. In 1919, Edgar Rice Burroughs used the money that he'd made writing Tarzan books to buy a big spread in the San Fernando Valley that he named for the Lord of the Jungle. He called it Tarzana. But a few years later he got bored in the country, moved to Beverly Hills, and subdivided Tarzana. But the name stuck, even though there wasn't anything about the neighborhood that evoked the character or the books. Ronnie had tried to change that. He bought a house in a Tarzana cul-de-sac, tore it down, and wanted to build in its place a massive treehouse with rope vines that he could use for swinging around his jungle property in a loincloth. But his plans were shot down by uptight neighbors and a gutless planning commission. So Ronnie ended up building a typical Spanish Mediterranean McMansion, with a lushly landscaped yard behind a high cinder block wall, topped with red ceramic tiles. Margot pulled up to the gate, her front bumper nearly touching the elaborately curled and entwined wrought iron so Ronnie, sitting in the back seat, could roll down his window and reach out to the security keypad on a driver's side post. Beyond the gate, the cobblestone driveway curved up through immaculately maintained grounds to the mansion and its six-car garage. Ronnie typed his code into the keypad.
"Welcome to the house that Franken-cop bought."
"Franken-cop?" Margot said. "What is that?"
"A TV show," Ian said. "It ran for 2 seasons on Fox."
"The best parts of 12 dead cops, resurrected as one legendary hero,"
Ronnie intoned dramatically, performing the lines that played over the main titles.
"The opening narration still moves me."
"Me too," Margot said. "It moves my breakfast right up my throat."
Ian peered out at the manicured lawns, perfectly trimmed trees, and blooming flower beds as the gate yawned open.
"The place looks great. Why do you pay to maintain it if you don't live here anymore?"
"I have to maintain the property value. I don't trust banks or currency because they're controlled by the New World Order, so I keep a large percentage of my wealth in real estate."
"And the rest in doubloons," Margot added as she drove up to the house.
"I also come back here now and then for crucial supplies."
"Like what?" Ian asked.
"Wanda,"
Ronnie said.
"L.A. is second only to Tokyo as the hotbed of the sex doll industry. Some dealers will even let preferred customers like me take the dolls out for a test drive. I can have one delivered in an hour."
"That's disgusting," Margot said. But for Ian Ludlow, it was inspirational. Until that moment, Ian didn't have a plan. Now he did. The plot began to fall into place, fitting together like Lego blocks. He didn't have the details yet, but he felt a familiar, reassuring rush of creative excitement. There was a book here, and that meant there was a chance at salvation for him, Margot, and Ronnie. They all got out of the car. Ronnie went to the door, unlocked it, and stepped inside, immediately setting off the alarm. He typed a code into the keypad by the door and deactivated the security system.
"Come on in," he said. "There are 6 bedrooms, 6 baths, 2 kitchens, a screening room, a wine cellar, and a 6-car garage.
The grand entry was the center of the house. It was 2 stories high, encircled by the open second floor, and illuminated by sunshine streaming in from a skylight. All the other wings of the house branched off from the hall like spokes on a wheel. The interior was professionally decorated in a California hacienda style that was about as warm, personal, and inviting as a model home.
"The Carrara marble on the floor and throughout the house is from the same Tuscan quarry as the slab that Michelangelo used to carve the statue of David, who has the same body as me, except I have a much bigger schlong," Ronnie said. "Michelangelo said the statues were already in the rock. He just had to bring them out. So everywhere you go in this house, you'll find the potential for greatness and a big marble cock all around you."
"That's a lot of money to pay for constant reassurance," Margot said.
"It's cheaper than seeing a shrink," Ronnie said.
"You should have seen the shrink instead." She checked her watch and turned to Ian. "Okay, time's up. Do you have a plan or not?" Ian smiled. "I do." And then he told her what it was. Chapter 37. The assassin Doric Thane arrived in Los Angeles tanned and thoroughly rested after his 7-day vacation in Hawaii. He practically had the entire island of Oahu to himself after he'd crashed the plane into Waikiki. The traumatized tourists couldn't wait to get off the island, and the traumatized locals stayed indoors. He checked out of the Diamond Head Hotel while Waikiki was still in flames, and moved to a condo in sleepy Kailua on the east end of the island, a mountain range between him and the devastation and chaos that he'd wrought. He spent his days swimming in the warm water, jogging on deserted beaches, and eating in empty restaurants, It was idyllic. After arriving at LAX, he took a shuttle to the long-term parking lot, found his car, and drove to the Universal City Oakwood, a complex of furnished temporary stay apartments on Barham Boulevard. The Oakwood was popular with businessmen, airline pilots and stewardesses, recently divorced fathers, and actors staying in L.A. for auditions, episodic guest shots or movie shoots. Visiting assassins liked it, too. The best part of staying there was the sex. Unless you had leprosy, it was almost impossible not to get laid. And even then, your chances were still pretty good. The assassin hadn't been called into the office or given an assignment, so he had time on his hands. Thane entered his apartment, changed into his Speedo, and went down to the pool, where there were several women sunbathing in bikinis for him to choose from. He picked a 20-something who seemed to be posing for a non-existent camera and was very proud of her new boobs. She had a right to be. Thane stretched out on the chaise lounge next to hers, asked if he could steal some of her suntan lotion since he'd forgotten his, and within 2 minutes he'd learned she was a stage actress from New York doing a guest shot on a cop show. "I play an international hit woman," she said with a sly smile. "My body is a lethal weapon."
"Wow," Thane said. "Should I be scared?"
"Absolutely. When I play a part, I get under the character's skin. In the script, it says that she's a sociopath, that killing is the only thing that excites her, that she actually feels." "That's bullshit. The writers have no clue who she is," the actress said, then leaned in close as if sharing a dark secret. "Do you want to know what's really going on in an assassin's mind?"
"Beyond the preparation for the kill and the escape afterward, they aren't thinking about anything at all," Thane said. "Taking a stranger's life is meaningless to them. It's a task to be performed, like a gardener pulling weeds." She dismissed his remark with a wave of her hand, like she was swatting away a fly buzzing around her head.
"That's completely wrong. Each time they kill someone, they're symbolically killing their parents, over and over, for the love they were denied. They're mourning their lost childhoods."
It was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard. He had a great relationship with his parents. They loved him unconditionally, though he wasn't tempted to test that belief by telling them that he'd hacked into an airplane and crashed it into Waikiki.
"That's fascinating," he said. "How do you know that?"
"I'm an actress," she said. "We instinctively find the emotional truth in a character."
"Does that work with real people, too?"
"Do you mean am I in tune with my own emotional truth?"
"No. I mean, can you find mine?"
She smiled and stole a glance at his barely there Speedo and everything it strained to contain. "Definitely."
Bethesda, Maryland, July 21st, 3:11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
"We got this from the Henderson Executive Airport parking lot," Seth said. "It shows the unknown subjects acquiring the Blackthorn vehicle that was left behind by Pessel and Bowers."
Cross watched pixelated video on the media wall of an old Ford station wagon pulling up beside the Suburban. Two men and a woman got out of the car, but their faces weren't visible because the surveillance camera was crappy. It was too dark outside, and the people were too far away. But Cross didn't need to see their faces to know who they were. It was Ludlow, French, and one more civilian they'd have to kill.
"This gives us no useful intel," Cross said.
"Not by itself," Seth said, "but an identical 1974 Ford Country Squire station wagon was parked in the Main Street Station Casino parking lot in direct line of sight of our Las Vegas office at the time of the blast."
A video appeared on the media wall showing a rocket-propelled grenade being fired from the casino parking lot by someone obscured by the station wagon.
"That gave us a vehicle to search for," Seth said. "That same station wagon drove through the California Agricultural Checkpoint on I-15 at Yermo, 140 miles southwest of Las Vegas, at 7:35 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. It wasn't stopped for inspection, but all the vehicles that go through are automatically photographed, and the license plates are captured."
Seth put the two photos up on the media wall, One was a close-up of the rear license plate, which Cross didn't need or care to see. The second was a close-up of the front of the vehicle, heading toward the camera. It clearly showed Ian Ludlow sitting in the passenger seat and Margot French at the wheel. Cross wanted to break Seth's neck. Seth should have immediately shown him the goddamn photo of Ian and Margot the instant he stepped into the room, and scrapped the whole tedious story leading up to it. But no, Seth wanted to show off his work and build up suspense, like he was putting on a fucking stage show. He'd wasted Cross's time, and that was unacceptable. Cross would deal with that later. Maybe transfer the smug prick to Tasmania. For now, he took a deep breath to calm himself.
"Show me a map of the I-15 heading southwest," Cross said.
One appeared immediately on the media wall. The I-15 went straight into Southern California. The only fork beforehand was near Barstow, California, where the I-15 met the I-40 eastbound toward Arizona, New Mexico, and the lower third of the country. But if any of those places was their destination, there were much shorter routes out of Las Vegas to get there. So Cross was sure they'd stayed on the I-15. Once they hit Victorville, they could take Highway 18 west, and from there hit several other routes leading to Central or Northern California. Or they could stay on the I-15 and connect to a number of southbound freeways toward San Diego and Mexico. Or they could take it straight into Los Angeles, Ian Ludlow's home.
"He's going back to Los Angeles," Cross said. He was sure of it, though it was just a gut feeling.
"He can't be," Victoria said. "That would be insane."
"More insane than breaking into our office in Las Vegas?" Seth said.
Victoria didn't reply. Seth had a point, Cross thought, and might even have the motive. Did Ludlow intend to strike their Beverly Hills office? Cross didn't think so. Ludlow wouldn't take the risk of returning to L.A., his home and the place where he was most likely to be spotted by his pursuers, unless he absolutely had to for a crucial strategic or operational purpose.
"The real question is what's in Los Angeles that he needs," Cross said, putting the question to the room.
"Money," Victoria said. Cross nodded. That was a real possibility. But Ludlow wouldn't be dumb enough to walk into a bank or go to an ATM for a withdrawal. That would announce his location almost instantly. So that meant he had either money stashed away somewhere, or someone he could approach for cash.
"Freeze his bank accounts, and stake out his house, or what's left of it," Cross said. "Maybe he had a floor safe or something. Doesn't he have family in Southern California?"
"His mother is in Palm Springs," Victoria said.
"Put a team on her," Cross said. "I want her watched 24/7, and all of her email, phone, and other communications monitored. What did you get from the license plate on the station wagon?"
"It's owned by the same shell companies as the compound in Nevada," Seth said. "We're digging into it. We have our people sorting through records in Delaware, Panama, Bermuda, and the Cayman Islands. We're hours away from an answer."
"Make it minutes," Cross said.
And if Seth strung out the answer when he got it, Cross might actually break the man's neck. Chapter 38. Woodland Hills, California, July 21st, 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Margot parked the Ford station wagon in front of the Target store on Ventura Boulevard and looked at Ian in the passenger seat. He took the foil-wrapped driver's license out of his pocket.
"If you want to quit," Ian said, "now is the time to do it."
"No, I'm in."
"So you think the plan will work?"
"Not really, but it's how I choose to die."
The sentence was barely out of her mouth before she started giggling like a little girl.
"I don't know how you can write or say that Straker shit with a straight face."
"It's simple. You have to believe it."
He peeled the foil from his driver's license, gave her a smile, and got out of the car. She watched him walk into the Target and disappear inside. Bethesda, Maryland, July 21st, 10:17 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Cross sat in his office, watching CIA Director Michael Healy's press conference, which was being aired live on every major TV network and cable news channel.
Ayub Darwish and Habib Ibrahimi, the two terrorists responsible for crashing Trans-American 976, and prior to that Indonesian Air 230, were killed yesterday in Antwerp, in a joint operation conducted by the CIA and Belgian intelligence, Healy said. The two men have familial ties to Harakat Harar el-Sham el-Islamiyah, a collection of radical Islamic terrorist groups based in Syria, and they worked on the Gordon Ganza assembly line when both of the aircraft were manufactured. Evidence found on computers and cell phones recovered at the scene in Antwerp conclusively ties the men to the downing of those jets. Poor Mike, Cross thought. It was his moment of glory, the kind of political coup that could easily propel a man of his youth to the Oval Office someday. Perhaps it would. But for now, he had to stand there, freshly castrated, a Ken doll in a suit who had nothing to do until Cross or Holbrook or the President decided to play with him. The Belgians were the luckiest bastards of all. They were given the shared glory for an intelligence coup that they not only had nothing to do with, but didn't know anything about until an hour or two before Healy's press conference. It was a gift, one that would allow them to downplay how Darwish and Ibrahimi were able to get into their country and remotely crash a plane in Honolulu from a barn outside of Antwerp, without Belgian intelligence knowing they were even there. His phone rang, and he snatched it up. "Yes?" "Ludlow has surfaced." It was Victoria calling from the control center.
"Where and when?"
"A Target store in Woodland Hills, California, 30 minutes ago. The alert in the National Known Shoplifter database paid off for us again. We got a hit from the RFID chip in his driver's license as he passed through the security scanners."
"I'll be right there."
When Cross entered the center, security camera video of Ludlow, taken from inside the Target store, was already playing on the media wall, along with satellite images of the store and the surrounding neighborhood. There were also security camera photos from the parking lot, showing Ludlow getting out of and into the old Ford station wagon.
"Do we know what Ludlow bought?"
Cross asked. 4 throwaway cell phones, hair coloring, toiletries and groceries," Victoria said. "But all the food was packaged goods. Nothing perishable like meat, fruit or vegetables." Ludlow was going into hibernation. If they lost him now, they might not have another shot at him until he made his next move against them. They had to take advantage of Ludlow's mistake while the opportunity was there.
"He's going back to ground, probably somewhere in Los Angeles," Cross said. "We have to move fast before we lose him. Get a surveillance drone up over the San Fernando Valley and try to home in on those RFID tags."
"He could be in Ventura by now," Victoria said, "or halfway to Pasadena."
"I think I know where he is," Seth said. "The one common denominator of those shell companies and bank accounts is that they all lead back through a lawyer or accountant to Ronald Mancuso, an actor Ludlow worked with on the TV series Hollywood and the Vine."
Publicity stills of Ronnie from his roles as Franken-Cop, Publicity Hound, and Charlie Vine appeared on the media wall.
"Mancuso has a home in Tarzana, a few miles away from that Target store."
Seth didn't know it, but he just saved himself from a one-way trip to Tasmania and the end of a once promising career. Cross turned to Victoria.
"Get me eyes on the house and dispatch a hit team."
"The asset we sent to Honolulu just got back to Los Angeles," Victoria said. It was perfect timing and a good omen. Doric Thane was their best assassin and utterly dependable. It was why Cross had entrusted him with downing the plane.
"Put him in charge of the team and give him a helmet camera," Cross said. "I want to see Ludlow die for myself."
Ronnie led Ian and Margot into his garage and proudly showed off the 6 cars parked inside. 1, the bright green 2011 Ford Crown Victoria from Hollywood and the Vine. 2, the black and gold 1977 Pontiac Trans Am from Smokey and the Bandit. 3, the red and white striped 1976 Ford Gran Torino from Starsky and Hutch. 4, a silver 1964 Aston Martin DB5, like the one James Bond drove in Goldfinger. 5, Kit, the jet black 1982 Pontiac Trans Am from Knight Rider. 6,
the Batmobile from one of the Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, or George Clooney string of Batman movies. Ronnie went over to the Batmobile and patted the hood.
I'm thinking this is the car for the job.
Ian went to the green Crown Vic, which had a set of ramming bars on the front grille, and gestured to it with a swing of the target bag in his right hand.
Let's go with this one. It's a bit more subtle than the others.
Not by much, Margot said.
Do you know what this car is?
Ronnie asked her.
Garish and ugly?
It's my ride from Hollywood and the Vine. Like the Batmobile, this car is rolling justice.
Ronnie lovingly stroked the side of the Crown Vic and then nodded at Ian.
You're right, buddy. Driving this will make it personal.
We don't have much time.
Ian reached into his bag and handed a cell phone to Margot and another to Ronnie, and kept the remaining two for himself. He looked Ronnie in the eye.
Are you sure you're okay with what might happen to you if this plays out the way we hope it will?
Absolutely, Ronnie said. It's a small price to pay to topple the New World Order.
Ian gave him a hug.
I owe you.
The hell you do,
Ronnie said, still in Ian's embrace.
This is the fight I've always wanted. You've given me a gift, buddy.
Ian stepped back.
Then you better get going.
Ronnie held out his arms to Margot for another hug, but she took a step back and offered him a friendly wave. Good luck?
Fuck luck, honey.
Ronnie stuck the phone in his pocket.
I was born for this. See you at the after party.
He got into the Crown Vic, used his remote to open the garage door, and drove out, burning rubber. Margot hit a button on the wall, closing the garage door. While she did that, Ian opened one of his two cell phones, typed *72, waited a moment, then began typing in a number with a 301 area code. Margot joined him and looked over his shoulder. Are you sure this is going to work?
Why are you asking me? It was basically your idea.
It was never an idea, she said. It was an example of something insane you could do to get yourself killed by the people who were chasing us.
Uh-oh, he said. I may have misunderstood.
I hate you, she said, and unpeeled the aluminum foil from her driver's license.
Chapter 39. Studio City, California. 7:20 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The actress found the assassin's emotional truth after her second bone-rattling orgasm.
I know who you are, she said,
catching her breath.
You do.
Doric Thane lifted his face from between her legs and climbed up beside her on the bed. They'd hardly spoken since they'd met at the pool, and even that didn't qualify as much of a conversation. He hadn't given her his name, not even a fake one. But she'd given him her full name, and when they arrived in her apartment, one of her headshots. Then she'd given him head. Now she rolled over to face him, her body damp with sweat, her nipples hard enough to cut glass.
You're alone, but not lonely. You are complete in yourself. Your pleasure comes from taking a job and doing it well, but that's where your personal investment ends. Your emotional truth is that you don't have any emotions beyond pride in your work.
She'd been way off the mark on how an assassin thinks, but Thane was impressed by how accurately she'd read him.
You got all that from how I fuck?
I'm guessing you're a surgeon.
Thane smiled. He liked that guess.
Why is that?
The way you handled my body and looked at me when I climaxed, she said. It was like you were studying the response of individual muscles to your actions.
Right again.
Very observant.
His phone vibrated on her nightstand. Thane sat up, grabbed the phone, and looked at the screen. It was a text message telling him he was needed urgently at the office. That was code for a high-priority kill, one that had to be done immediately. He bent down and picked up his Speedo off the floor.
I have to go.
Thane stood and pulled on his Speedo in the same motion.
An emergency at the office.
He headed for the door.
Wait, I have to know,
she said, propping herself up on her elbows.
How close was I?
He paused at her door, thought about his answer, and turned back to her.
I'm an exterminator.
She looked like she'd just eaten something sour.
You mean like rats and cockroaches?
It's always my parents.
He walked out without taking her headshot. The actress would go on to enjoy some fame 2 years later as the wacky neighbor with the beehive hairdo in the long-running CBS sitcom Geez Louise. But all four of her marriages would be destroyed by her adultery, a consequence of her futile quest to achieve the ecstasy that she'd experienced for 3 glorious hours with a stranger, a man she would never know was one of the biggest mass murderers in history. Beverly Hills, California, July 21st, 7:45 p.m., Pacific Standard Time. Blackthorn occupied a sleek, 8-story monolith of black glass a few blocks west of Rodeo Drive. A 10-pound surveillance drone camouflaged to blend in with the sky, lifted off from the top of the building. The drone had 4 helicopter-like propellers branching off from a central hub that held multiple high-definition cameras, an RFID scanner, and heat sensors. It circled once over the adjacent buildings, where Blackthorn snipers were keeping watch on the rooftops in case Ludlow attacked, and then it streaked out to the San Fernando Valley, the killing field. Ronnie walked into the restroom of the Chevron station on Van Nuys Boulevard, but 20 minutes later, it was Detective Charlie Vine who walked out. He wore a cheap suit and had a badge clipped to his belt. His hair was vibrant green and matched the color of his Crown Vic. He got into the car and sped off, the theme from Hollywood and the Vine blasting from his stereo. Ooh, you heard about that cop Vine? A plant who can't stand crime. You get caught, you're gonna do time. Honey, honey, yeah. In the basement armory of Blackthorn's Beverly Hills office, Doric Thane and 5 other men suited up in their black tactical gear and prepared for battle. They wore ballistic helmets with cameras, night vision goggles, armored vests, knee pads, and duty belts loaded with stun grenades, pepper spray, doorstops, flashlights, and extra magazines and rounds of ammunition. They were armed with knives, Sig Sauer P226 semi-automatic pistols, and Heckler & Koch HK416 assault rifles with suppressors and mounted lights. Doric Thane thought that killing by laptop with a cocktail in your hand was a lot easier on the lower back than carrying all of this, but it wasn't nearly as much fun. A flat-screen TV on the wall displayed pictures of their 3 targets, Ian Ludlow, Margot French, and Ronald Mancuso. Wilton Cross's voice came through on the speaker, giving them their marching orders.
This is a stealth operation, swift and quiet. The targets are well-trained and heavily armed. They have already killed 3 of our agents, shot down 1 of our helicopters, and bombed our Las Vegas offices. Don't underestimate them. Kill them on sight. Leave no witnesses.
Roger that, Thane said.
He led the man out of the armory and into the underground garage, where they split up, got into the 2 waiting black panel vans, and raced out of the building. Some cliches are true. Cops really do love donuts and coffee. That's especially true for California Highway Patrol officers. That's because donut shops offer a cheap, quick fix of sugar and caffeine. They're open all hours, and they can usually be found within 2 blocks of any freeway off-ramp in Los Angeles County. Rolly's Donuts, where CHP officers Brubeck and Flotz were taking a break, was a good example. It was 1 block south of the Coldwater Canyon off-ramp of the 101 freeway, and there was almost always a police car parked in the lot. This time it was their black and white CHP Ford Explorer. Flotz held his glazed, old-fashioned donut in front of his face, and pondered its beauty and complexity.
Donuts are an American delicacy.
You bet. Right up there with fried chicken and barbecue ribs.
Brubeck slurped some of his coffee. He and his partner were both in their mid-30s, as pale as vampires from working nights, and 1 belt buckle notch away from having to buy wider pants. They sat at a window table along the street. They weren't paying attention to the parking lot or the alley behind it. Neither one of them noticed the green Crown Vic that pulled up behind the dumpsters. If they had, they probably would have mistaken it for a cop driving a plain wrap, coming in for a break.
So why is it that Koreans make the best donuts?
Flotz gestured to the Korean woman who sat on a stool behind the counter, reading a Korean language newspaper.
The donuts in this place have been terrific for 47 years, Brubeck said, long before Fat Rolly retired and sold the place to Ho Chi Minh.
That's Vietnamese. I'm talking about Koreans.
My point is that the Koreans, the Vietnamese, and other Asians bought up all the old mom-and-pop donut shops and the recipes came with the deal, Brubeck said. What they're good at is following recipes.
Flotz took a bite and savored it.
I bet if an American bought the place, the donuts would taste like shit. That's my point.
The Crown Vic slammed into the trash bin, the sound of the crash immediately getting the attention of the two cops. They turned around just as the Crown Vic bulldozed the bin right into the driver's side of their Explorer, T-boning it.
What the fuck? Brubeck said.
The Crown Vic backed up, tires squealing, and then charged forward again, plowing into the bin and pushing the Explorer through the plate glass window of the donut shop. Brubeck and Flotz ducked for cover from the flying glass. They drew their weapons and stood up to see a man with green hair in the driver's seat of the Crown Vic, waving at them as he sped into traffic on Coldwater Canyon. Both cops took aim, but neither could get a clear shot without hitting other passing cars. The Crown Vic fishtailed as it made a sharp turn south toward Ventura Boulevard. Flotz grabbed the radio clipped on his shoulder and called in the cavalry. The media wall showed a drone's eye view of Ronnie's house and the Ford station wagon parked in the motor court. A separate video window opened up on the wall, showing the layout of the house and two red pulses upstairs. Those were good signs. Victoria spoke up, sharing information from her computer screen. The drone is getting positive RFID hits on Ludlow's driver's license, French's driver's license, and the target purchases. We also have two heat signatures upstairs.
It was almost certain that Ludlow and French were in the house, but the third man, the actor, could be anywhere.
Cross frowned. There would still be a rogue element left after Ludlow and French were finally off the field. This was the fuck-up that never stopped giving.
We've hacked into the house's surveillance camera system through a back door in their ancient router, Seth said. We've disabled the alarms, and we've recorded the last 60 seconds of footage of the grounds. We are rerunning it in a loop, in case anyone inside the house is watching the monitors. They won't see what's coming.
Cross turned to Victoria.
ETA?
5 minutes, she said. Chapter 40. The first thing that Margot did when she and Ian walked into the bedroom was turn on the TV to the local news. The lead story was live coverage of a high-speed police chase on the westbound Ventura Freeway, which was less than a block north of Ronnie's house and ran parallel to the boulevard. They stood in front of the TV set and stared at the video from the Channel 2 news chopper. It showed Ronnie's bright green Crown Vic, illuminated by a spotlight from an LAPD helicopter and being pursued by four CHP patrol cars.
At least a green paint job makes the car easy to spot from the air, Margot said, taking out her cell phone and beginning to dial.
I'm glad you're seeing the positive side of things, Ian said, and went to the next room. He also had a call to make, and he didn't want to hear the TV. Ronnie's house backed up against a lightly wooded hillside that was owned by the county. A private road led up the hill to an 8-million-gallon water tank. The gravel lot around it, the romantic spot where hundreds, if not thousands, of teenagers over the last 40 years had drunk their first beer, inhaled their first joint, and lost their virginity, making it worthy by Los Angeles standards of historic preservation and a brass plaque. Like actresses, anything over 40 that was still standing in Los Angeles was considered ancient. A blackthorn van rolled up the county road with its lights off and parked above Ronnie's property. The three killers got out, rifles drawn, and moved methodically down the hillside, wary of any hidden threats. At the same time, the other Blackthorn van arrived in front of the house. Thane and two of his men spilled out, climbed on top of the van, and from there they easily scaled Ronnie's wall and dropped down silently on the other side. Thane and his men advanced on the house, ready to engage the enemy. At the same time, the other team closed in from the rear. The attention of every operative in the Blackthorn Situation Room was on the media wall, which was split into thirds. The first third showed the point of view from Thane's camera helmet as he led his team toward the house. The second showed the drone's night vision camera view of the property, and the six men who were approaching the house from the front and the rear. The last third showed the drone's heat sensor display of the property, tracking the six men closing in on the house, and the two people in bedrooms on the second floor.
"Any activity in the neighborhood?" Cross asked. "Any calls to the police?"
"All quiet," Seth said. "And even if there were, the police are occupied with a pursuit on the Ventura Freeway."
A police pursuit is daily news in Los Angeles, like the weather or sports, Victoria said.
"Thank you, OJ," Seth said.
Cross nodded to himself, pleased. Finally, luck was on their side. Ronnie's car was bathed in the police chopper's spotlight as he weaved through the moderate freeway traffic toward the White Oak exit. The news chopper's cameraman kindly gave Margot a wide-angle view of what lay ahead for Ronnie. She could see two lines of cars stacked up at the White Oak exit because of a red light at the bottom of the off-ramp.
"Don't use the White Oak exit," Margot warned Ronnie on the phone. "There's a backup and you'll get pinned. The next exit at Reseda looks clear."
She could hear an action-adventure, percussion-heavy instrumental version of "I Heard It Through the Grapevine" playing on his car stereo.
"Gotcha," Ronnie said, as he passed the White Oak off-ramp. "But I have a better idea, Hollywood."
"Don't call me that," she said. "This is not a TV show."
But that wasn't entirely true. She was watching him on TV, and as she spoke, he made a sharp U-turn on the freeway and headed down the White Oak on-ramp. It was an insane car chase stunt worthy of prime time. Ronnie charged down the shoulder, narrowly avoiding collisions with oncoming cars and scraping the wall along the edge of the embankment, then made a hard turn southbound onto White Oak, nearly clipping a bus making the turn onto the on-ramp.
"Woo-wee!" Ronnie roared.
The bold, propulsive music he was playing was the perfect score for the action. For a moment, she almost forgot that she was watching live TV and not a Hollywood and the Vine rerun.
"Oh my God," the anchorman said. "The driver is a lunatic."
The anchorman's astute observation snapped Margot back to reality. Or at least what was passing for it lately. Ronnie's car disappeared briefly from the chopper's view under the freeway overpass, then reappeared speeding south toward Ventura Boulevard.
"You thought going the wrong way down a freeway on-ramp was a better idea than simply taking the next exit?" Margot said.
"It was definitely more fun," Ronnie said. "It was also the unpredictable thing to do, which is always the right choice if you don't want to get caught."
"You could get yourself and a lot of other people killed," she said. "I know you're fleeing from the police, but you can do it responsibly."
"Loosen up, Hollywood. You're stiffer than my Uncle Oak, and he's a tree."
Cross watched the assault from Doric Thane's POV as the assassin and his two men entered Ronnie's brightly lit house and moved into the entry hall, which was a two-story atrium with a staircase on the far end. It was a big space, open to the second floor. The three men were completely exposed. If an ambush was coming, it would be here and now. Ludlow and French, armed with AK-47s, could mow them all down from above, or drop a couple of hand grenades and splatter them on the walls. Thane's men were well aware of their vulnerability. They pointed their weapons up, covering their leader as he made his way to the stairs. It was very tense, and everyone was silent in the Situation Room. Cross's phone vibrated in his jacket, startling him. Nobody called him on this phone unless it was priority Blackthorn business. What could be more important than what was happening right now?
There could be a crisis somewhere involving a major client, like one of the third world dictators they were propping up. Or perhaps it was something involving the president's imminent secret executive order. As much as he wanted to, he couldn't ignore the call. He took the phone out of his pocket and answered it. "Cross," he said. "Hello, Willie. This is Ian. I understand you've been looking for me." Ian's voice hit Cross like a gut punch. This call was the ambush. It had to be. But what was the trap? He didn't know if the call was being recorded or broadcast, so he'd have to choose his words wisely. Cross snapped his fingers to get Victoria's attention and replied more loudly to Ian than he needed to.
"I just wanted to express how much I enjoy your spy thrillers, Mr. Ludlow, even if they are a bit far-fetched."
The instant Victoria heard Ludlow's name, she got the message to trace the call, and she urgently typed commands on her keyboard.
"But lately my stories have been so true to life, don't you think, Willie?" Ian said. "Like that plane crash in Honolulu, for example. It's almost as if I've written the day's news myself."
Chapter 41. Ronnie drove westbound in the eastbound lanes of Ventura Boulevard, straight into oncoming traffic. Pursued by a posse of police cars, their sirens wailing and lights flashing to warn drivers about what was coming at them. He swerved around the oncoming cars, occasionally drifting into the center turning lane, then back into traffic again. The stunned TV anchor team, a man and a woman, and their Sky 2 chopper pilot provided ongoing commentary, frequently stating the obvious just to fill the airtime.
"Wayne, is that a spike strip they are laying down?" the anchor woman asked the pilot. "I see some activity in the top corner of the screen."
The chopper's camera view shifted from Ronnie for a moment to the road ahead and zoomed in. The police had blocked traffic at the intersection with Reseda Boulevard and were laying a spike strip across Ventura Boulevard in both directions.
"Yes, it is, Trixie," the chopper pilot said. "This is a very dangerous driver who has to be stopped."
He would be, too, if he didn't have Margot watching out for him. She spoke into the phone.
"They put a spike strip down across all the lanes at Reseda."
In response, Ronnie made a sudden hard left onto a residential side street. One of the police cars tried to follow him and clipped a truck, sending both vehicles spinning and causing a chain reaction pileup.
"Yee-haw!"
Ronnie yelled, leaving the destruction in his wake, but not his pursuers. The police cars at the Reseda intersection quickly peeled off, joining the chase. One LAPD chopper and three from local TV news stations also followed him overhead. And according to ratings released by the Nielsen Company the following week, 800,000 Los Angelinos were watching him, too. Doric Thane reached the top of the stairs, his two men behind him, covering his back. The second team remained outside, guarding the perimeter in case the targets tried to escape. But the intel Thane got in his earpiece from the Blackthorn Situation Room confirmed that Ludlow and French were still in the two bedrooms at the end of the hall. And the surveillance drone circling the house was still sensing their body heat and pinging their driver's licenses. The drone even sensed that the ding-dongs, potato chips, and dry salami that they bought at Target were still in the kitchen. All that remained to do was kill them and grab a ding-dong for the road.
"I wouldn't be surprised if you were in the news yourself tomorrow," Cross said to Ian.
On the media wall, he could see Thane's slow advance down the hall toward an open bedroom door.
"That's why I'm calling," Ian said, "to let you know how my latest thriller ends and what tomorrow's news will be."
Victoria got up from her seat and handed a note to Cross. "He's calling from the house." Cross smiled at her in reply to Ian.
"I think I may already know the ending."
Thane burst into the bedroom, saw a woman in a negligee on the bed, and shot her three times before he even had a good look at her. The first bullet punctured her head and popped out her left eyeball. The other two rounds disappeared into the cleavage between her huge breasts. A split second after he pulled the trigger,
He noticed the troubling absence of brain and blood splatter. In the next instant, he saw the electrical cord running from her back to a wall plug, and the glass eyeball rolling across the hardwood floor to his feet, and knew he was in deep shit.